You're listening to the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We have no truck with profanity here, but those of you of a more squeamish disposition may wish to exercise caution before tuning in. Hello, and welcome to Morbid Curiosities, a new show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid. I am your host, George Colley.
And I'm your other host, Rosie Cole. We are the principals of
Gimcrack Productions,
a live theatre and performance company. In the making of our shows, we research some very interesting topics.
Like
and
death.
Now we want to share that research with you.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we got today?
Well, we're continuing our delving into the Cabinet of Death. Mm-hmm. We're halfway through the alphabet. So in celebration time, we're up to M.
Celebrate good times, come on.
We're going to celebrate by lingering on M for a little while. So we've got two M topics for you today. And I'm going to start us off. First up, M is for... These are delicious. Do you want them?
Are they celebration?
Yeah, sure. Celebration sweets.
What's in them?
They're sweet. They're very sweet. They're honey. A lot of honey in there. You like honey?
Yeah, what else? Because it doesn't look like it's not just honey. Like,
well, no, of course it's not just honey. It's just, try it. It's delicious. It's
sure?
Good for you. Yeah, they're good for you. Full of vitamins.
Really?
So, yeah. Chewier than you expect. But very sweet, very honey. Mm. Hang on, let me look at the label. Wow, it's 100 years old, apparently. That explains the price.
Very rare. It tastes a bit weird.
Yeah, no, let me check the ingredients. So it says here it actually treats broken and wounded limbs. Have you got any broken or wounded limbs?
No, I'm fine.
Well, imagine what it can do for a healthy body if it can treat a broken limb. So ingredients, honey, it's mostly honey, and an old man.
What?
Old man, 70 to 80 years old.
Please stop eating that.
It's really good.
No.
Okay, so M is in fact for... medicine, corpse medicine, and I'm going to start...
Did you actually make me just eat an old man?
Yes, I'm going to start with these delicious honeyed treats, which, as far as you, the listener, are concerned, we have, in fact, been eating for the last couple of minutes. What I'm talking about here is something called mellified man. Mellified meaning honeyed.
Yeah, I got that.
As in mellifluous, honeyed words, mellifluous. And this is something which I was disappointed to find out in my research was not widely practiced, if at all. There was a 16th century Chinese naturalist called Li Shichen, and in 1597 he published a compendium entitled Chinese Materia Medica, and in it is the following recipe. Take one man, 70 to 80 years old, a willing volunteer, it says, have him agree to eat and drink nothing but honey for the rest of his life, which will be about a month. Then when he's dead, you shove him in a coffin full of honey for 100 years. Then you break him out of the coffin, chop him into bits and eat him up. And what do you know? He's a cure-all. He'll fix a broken limb.
That is not...
admirable.
...my dessert of choice.
Okay. Well, that's probably because you don't have any broken limbs. If you're in terrible pain because your fibula was sticking out of your tibia or whatever, it's not a medical podcast. you'd probably be grateful to have it.
I don't know if I would choose mellified man. I would probably go more for opium.
I'd probably go in for opium as well. So there you go. It's described in that compendium as miden, which translates as honey person. And it's worth pointing out, and this is where I got really crushingly disappointed, that this compendium, as far as I can tell, is the only source which actually reports on people being mellified. And further to that, the compendium reports it from another source, who in turn reports it as something done in, and I quote, the lands of the Arabs. It's all very non-specific, and Shichen himself says, I myself do not know whether the tale is true or not. In any case, I append it for the consideration of the learned.
So, apart from forcing a poor old man to eat so much honey that he dies in a month, and then preserving him in honey, and then using him as medicine...
I repeat that the old man was specifically a volunteer.
Fine.
Odd conversation
to
envisage. Grandad, I was wondering.
How much honey do you think you want to eat for the rest of your very
like
short
honey.
Life? apart from the mellified man, people didn't use dead bodies for other medicinal purposes, did they?
They did, and you know they did. Okay, so staying with the letter M, from mellified man to mummia. That's not the plural for mummy. That is a word for mummy powder.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, delicious, delicious mummy powder. It's also a word for wax, and by extension a word for bitumen. I'm going to come back to that, and it's going to get confusing, so stick with me. Powdered mummy was a huge, huge fad in 12th to 17th century European medicine. No apothecary worth his bath salts was without a healthy supply of ground-up mummy powder for sale for the treatment of pretty much everything. Mummy powder will sort you out for a headache, stomach ulcers, you can slather it on a plaster and put it over a tumour.
Snort it for a cold.
Hadn't thought of that one, but I bet you could, and I'm absolutely sure someone tried. Worth pointing out that in the vast majority of places, the product that you would buy in 12th to 17th century Europe when you were asking for mummia or mummy powder would not come from an actual mummy. Any old body would be dug up, ground up, and sold as mummy powder. Which, if you're going to fake it, why not just grind up a tree?
I bet people did. I bet they cut it with, like, sawdust and stuff.
This mummy's been stepped on three times. Street value's through the roof. Step on means cut drugs.
I knew that. My confused face doesn't show on the podcast.
I was just going to say, listeners, I wish I could describe the confusion on Rosie's face just then when I used the street slang that I learned from The Wire.
I got a very vivid image of someone stamping on a corpse.
Just stomping on a corpse until it's powder. I'm going to skip over some details here, and in their place I'm going to mention a podcast, which is one which has been a great inspiration to us here at Morbid Curiosities HQ, and that's Sawbones, S-A-W, Bones, a podcast about weird and stupid medical history, and specifically the episode entitled Medical Cannibalism. We urge you to tune into that podcast, particularly.
It's really good. It's very funny and very well researched, so if you like this, you'll like Sawbones.
So here's where it gets super stupid, because the use of ground up human bodies as a medicine may have resulted entirely from a linguistic misunderstanding revolving around the word mummia. I mentioned before that mummia is a word for bitumen. Bitumen was, many centuries ago, used to treat, among other things, arthritis. So bitumen was recognised as a medicinal substance back then. This Persian word for wax, mummia, was used to describe bitumen as well. That word mummia was also used to describe a resin used in the mummification process as practiced by ancient Egyptians. You might have guessed that it's also the root word for the term mummy, as we use it to describe a purpose desiccated body. So it seems like European apothecaries mistook mummia, as in medicinal bitumen, to mean the substance of mummified bodies, and so, ridiculously, a hugely popular medicinal industry grew out of that simple linguistic mistake. Aren't people fascinating?
That's really dumb.
Least stupid.
That's really quite bad. We would take lots of mummies and make them into medicine rather than preserve them for archaeological and anthropological reasons.
Lord knows how many ancient corpses were just ground to dust and eaten by people. It's a strange episode in human history.
Like so many.
A few more examples. Thai bowel capsules. Mary Roach is a fascinating author, as you well know, Rosie.
Her book Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers is one of my favourites.
Like Sawbones, if what you're hearing on this podcast is of interest to you, Stiff is a good way to go as well.
She's written some great books.
The book mentions reports of a medication called Thai bowel capsules, T-A-I-B-A-O, which supposedly contain powdered placenta and aborted fetal tissue. Now, from a cursory look, it seems like ingesting fetal and placental tissue does have some medicinal value. That's all I'm going to say about it for now, but there is a claim from customs officials in South Korea that some 17,500 such pills were seized in about 2011. Anyone at home who wants to Google Thai bao pills, there's plenty you can find out about them that way. There do seem to be a lot of examples on sale. No mention of ingredients, just the occasional mention of what they might be good for.
That's gross.
Or very resourceful.
I know people can, like, turn their own placenta into pills to eat. Or some people just eat it. They just fry it up and eat it.
Very rich in vitamins.
As a vegetarian, I'm not particularly into that idea. So what other kind of dead people stuff have we used for medicine?
Human fat. That's super handy.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really?
Big tub of human fat. Joint pain, bone pain, muscular cramps, nerve damage, arthritis, rheumatism, plenty of others could all be dealt with a liberal application of salves of human fat. Also gout, if you just rub the fat directly on the affected area. Human fat shows up in a lot of the pharmacopoeias of Europe from the 16th century onwards. Often the corpses of executed criminals or combatants would be brought to labs where their fat would be rendered and could then be sold as medicine. In the Netherlands, it's reported that hangmen would sometimes make their money by selling ointments made from the people they had executed. And as recently as 1922, there is mention in the American Journal of Pharmacy of a substance called hangman's fat being in vogue among the Dutch. That was in 1922, and it's worth noting they did outlaw capital punishment 70 years earlier.
Don't really have anything to say about that, except for I would probably not use it.
Only if you knew what it was made of. You could have been using it the whole time. Okay, you know, okay, what I'm human not... fat is a vital ingredient in? Ibuprofen.
What?
No, I made that up.
Okay, I'm not into this one either. Give me another one. I want okay. a different cure. I'm feeling unwell. I want something else.
Sweat?
Yeah, no.
Cup of sweat to wash down your mellified man?
Have you gone running? You've got lots of sweat.
I do have... Thank you. No, because it's specifically the sweat of a dying man.
Oh, no. Yeah. No.
It has to be...
Please don't die.
It has to be terror of imminent death sweat. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Really?
Yeah, if you want to cure your hemorrhoids. There's a chap called George Thompson, who was a physician in 17th century England. He prescribed the sweat of a dying man as a cure for hemorrhoids. If the executioner wasn't thoughtful enough to gather the sweat, you could instead just take the hand of the recently bereft corpse and rub it all over your hemorrhoids.
Oh my god!
And why wouldn't you? I mean, hemorrhoids are uncomfortable, and the only way to avoid that discomfort is to rub a dead man's hand on your... The people who came up with this had essentially the same, like, neurological equipment as us. So you've got to think, what was the logical stepping stone?
Oh, tried his nose, that didn't work.
Someone just spent weeks and weeks in a lab rubbing different parts of dead people's bodies over different afflicted areas of living sick people's bodies.
Oh my god.
And the one person who got cured was someone who had a corpse's hand rub over his hemorrhoid. Thusly,
is it
legitimate cure? It's not practiced today. Epilepsy.
I don't have that.
Epilepsy. For some reason, there is a particular pattern throughout history of people thinking dead humans can cure epilepsy. All the way back to ancient Roman times, it was widely thought that the liver and blood of a vigorous young man was curative, and in particular, defeated gladiators were harvested for their blood medicine. It's documented in some places, actually, that refreshment stands of a sort were set up at gladiator fights with blood for sale as a refreshing drink. In 17th century Europe, two men, an English doctor called John French and a German chemist called Johann Schroeder, came up with recipes for epilepsy cures made of human
toenails.
Brains. Close. Other end of the body. In fact, when I said close, you couldn't have been much further. French's cure involved steeping mashed brains, specifically those of a young man who had died violently, in wine and horse dung for half a year. Again, there had to be a path of intelligent thought which led
so
to this idea.
Wrong. Also, why would you put brains with horse poop? And then some what? I mean, like, you'd need the wine to wash it down.
There must have been some reason why horse dung and wine specifically added to brains would have made sense as a curative recipe back then. People are weird.
I was really questioning our current period in history this week after recent events and about how awful the world is right now. But you know what? We have actually made a bit of progress.
Yeah, in the last few hundred years, we've taken some steps.
I mean, at least we're not eating mashed brains and horse dung.
Although, maybe it worked. Food for thought. The other man's recipe, Johann Schroeder's, was a little more pleasant. It involved an infusion of lily, lavender and Malmsey. I think he was probably the more practiced salesman of the two.
I can imagine them side by side.
I can imagine there's, every time you see Johann Schroeder, there's a terrific fanfare, a sort of da-da-da-da! And then every time John French shows up,
because of course it
I
was
filled
the,
it with poo.
Of course it was the English doctor who put poop in it.
From
it
the country
so
that brought you Prince Charles. At a similar time and place in Europe, the blood of the recently executed was prized for epilepsy. To the point where people would stand at the block and hold out cups to catch the fresh blood as it spurted out of old Deddo's neck. I did in fact turn up one report of an afflicted old man grabbing the freshly executed head and presumably turning to the crowd and making some brilliant quip about cutting out the middleman, just drinking the blood straight out of the neck. So that's something that happened. There's a few others I could mention. The recipe for distilled human skull, which was made famous by Charles II and sold as the King's Drops. A, and I quote, marmalade of sorts, cooked up by European monks from human blood. The supposedly medicinal moss that grew on a dead man's skull. But instead of talking about those, I wanted to talk about the equivalent, as we have it today, the corpse medicine, if you will, of the 21st century. Something that we here at Gimcrack Productions consider very important is posthumous organ donation. Folks, you're not going to need them. And it's strange to think of it as the same sort of field of medicine, but really, organ donation is a kind of corpse medicine, as it were. It is using the resources of the deceased as medicinal help for the living.
But much more effectively than mashing brains up with some horse poo.
Considerably more effectively, yeah. So I just thought that was an interesting perspective to have, that organ donation is in fact corpse medicine. It seems to fit into the same history as the things that I've been describing so far.
But better.
Clearly a more refined process.
We're actually going to do an episode on organ donation.
Which is why I'm not going to linger on it for too long.
But good point. Hadn't even thought of that.
Have you thought, though, of beating heart cadavers?
No.
This is really, really fascinating. Another thing which is certainly at least related to the history of corpse medicine is the beating heart cadaver. A confluence of factors can lead a person to be in a state which was once coined in French as coma dépassé, literally a state beyond coma. In this state, the organs of the body can continue to function, though an electroencephalograph will show that there is no brain activity, which essentially means the person is irretrievably dead, though the organs of the body continue to function. It's strange to think that just in the 50s, the medical community discovered this state and uncovered what might be considered a new subcategory of death, wow. A new state of being somewhere between alive and dead. So the advantage of this is that transplantable organs can be kept, as it were, fresh. And the real world result in medical terms is that twice as many organs, and that equates to about 3.9 organs per body, statistically, can be harvested from a beating heart cadaver, which is kept going until the recipient of a transplant is ready on the table.
Wow.
Also, and this is huge, beating heart cadavers are currently the only fully reliable source of hearts for transplant. The conversation, which we don't have time for right now, is what this means for the definition of death. If you really look into it, there is no specific moment of death. Rather, a person dying is a series of shutting downs of systems. Obviously, the brain has shut down in the case of a beating heart cadaver. And as was discovered not long ago, there are genes in the human genome which actually spring to life after death has occurred. So when does death actually happen? It wasn't until 1846 that a scientist, one Eugene Bouchoux, a Frenchman, defined clinical death as a lack of detected heartbeat by a stethoscope for 2 minutes. Decades later came the defibrillator, which complicated that definition, and after that the electroencephalograph, which I mentioned earlier, which measures brain activity, which complicated it further. This is a very philosophical question about where and how we define death, and I fear that in talking here about corpse medicine, ancient and modern, I have strayed off topic.
It's all getting a bit serious and a bit...
bit like a direful digression.
There we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to Morbid Curiosities.
Yes, thank you for tuning in once again. We're having a great time doing this podcast.
Our listener question last week was,
what is your favourite euphemism for death, or would you like to make one up?
Yeah, we got some enthusiastic responses. Straight away, Ed told us, shuffling off this mortal coil. And I'm not going to repeat exactly what he said, but he thinks it's very poetic. Pushing Daisies, says Poppy. She's also a fan of Departing This Vale of Tears.
I really like that one.
Is that a Shakespeare as well?
I'm not sure.
Stephanie, regular contributor. Stephanie has given us That Big Coffee Break in the Sky from Sweet Charity. Lady May says, I have an ex that wanted to die dramatically at 45, tanned, thin and handsome, in a bath of venomous snakes. And he thought that if people copied it as a technique, people would say that their method was doing a Stanley. Which, let's hope that catches on. Lady May, do keep us updated on what your ex is up to and if he's successfully coined that phrase. Gerard, immortality challenged!
Who else have we got? The lovely Mark, whose radio show we were on last week, said he likes Pushing Up the Daisies, Snuffed It, and Pulling a Stiffy, which he says he made that last one up.
That's going to sound good in church.
Kim also likes Shuffling Off This Mortal Coil.
It's a really, really elegant phrase, Shuffling Off This Mortal Coil. I don't know what the word coil actually refers to there. Like, does coil reference something other than a sort of...
We should ask Shakespeare.
Okay, yeah, I'll go dig up Shakespeare.
And Electra likes eating the dandelions by its roots, which is a Frenchism.
Clara says, in Colombia, we say, putting on your wooden shirt.
And it's really interesting that both of those are really similar to phrases we have in English, like putting on a wooden overcoat and pushing daisies. And then Amy said she likes pining for the fjords, but that one comes from the Dead Parrot sketch by Monty Python, which I now definitely have to rewatch.
James says buying the farm.
Oh yeah, buying the farm.
Oh, and Hell says sleeping with the fishes. He sleeps with the fishes.
Kind of sinister.
Luca Brazzi. Did you have any more there?
Yes, Al gave us a fantastic response yet again. Al likes the classical references, such as paying the ferryman, crossing the Styx, to dine in Hades, going down to pay his debt, or Nordic references, such as taking his place at the table, to feast in the halls of Valhalla, to be among them. And then he's posted an amazing sonnet or poem called from a book called The Eaters of the Dead. And then a few piratical references. Maritime. Piratey. Yeah, kind of maritime references. Going down to see Old Hob and going down to the Hot Place or Davy Jones' Locker.
Now, I don't know who Old Hob is.
We should look that up.
Yeah.
That's... Next time on Morbid Curiosities, we meet Old Hob. So these are all great answers.
What about you, Rosie?
I quite like going to see the Choir Invisible. That's quite fun.
It's a nice poetical one. I like
it. Monty Python.
Yeah, nice one. I don't know if Cleese and Co. came up with that.
I did like sticking a spoon in the wall.
Sticking a spoon in the wall is good. I think from after last week, my favourite is going trumpet cleaning.
I still don't get it.
Neither do I. I think that's why I like it.
This week's listener question. What is your favourite historical remedy? Doesn't have to be corpse medicine.
Doesn't have to be functional.
No. But what do you know historically and what would you say? Yeah, I'd give that a go.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's a ground up mummy. If you want to catch us live, there are a few places you can see us in the coming weeks. It is 1 week until our Death Positive Extravaganza Moribund
opens. Is on its way.
Yeah, it will be at Crazy Cox, Brasserie ZL on the 22nd of November.
That is Tuesday week from when this has been published.
We are on Yplan, where you can get a small discount on tickets for the show. So do catch that. Come along and see us. We've also got 3 more Tuesdays after that one in a row.
So next show is Tuesday the 22nd.
And we are also very lucky to be part of Tattoo and Tees at the Latin Angel Studio in Richmond, which is going to be on the 17th of December. And that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun little Christmas oddness.
So that's where you can find us out in the world. Or if you want to talk to us, you can find us on the internet. On Twitter at...
Jim Crack Shows.
On Facebook at...
facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1.
On our website...
www.JimCrackProductions.com.
And on Instagram at...
Jim Crack Productions.
I've really been thinking about that that mummy powder.
What about it?
Well...
You need me to go out and get you some?
Have you
got a bit of anything which you need cured?
I'm thinking about it because you actually stole part of my topic this week. Which is...
I can steal things with my brain.
Waiting for this for so long. It's mummies! I get to talk about mummies.
I see you have 9 pages of notes.
Thousands of words on mummies. There is so much to say about different types of mummies that I got a little overwhelmed. So this is the heavily edited version. But if you want to go see some mummies, there's an excellent part of the British Museum, which has an exhibit on mummies. And there is also an excellent exhibit in New York at the Metropolitan Museum.
Yes, which we saw just a couple of years ago.
Yes, we've been to both. I've been to both multiple times. Because they're
New York. Yeah. So what's a mummy?
What is a mummy indeed? As you mentioned, the term mummy actually comes from the word mummia, which is the word for bitumen, which was also used in the mummification process. So people thought it just meant the entity of the mummy rather than the specific thing. Well done, colonial England.
Yes,
really getting it right once again.
Super good. That's right up there with calling Native Americans Indians.
A mummy is a deceased human or animal whose skin and organs have been preserved either intentionally or accidentally by environmental factors.
Accidentally?
Yes. You can have accidental mummy. Because it's not to do with the method of preservation, it's to do with the fact that it has been preserved either due to extreme cold, low humidity, or lack of air, so the body doesn't actually decay further if kept in cool and dry conditions. In some way, this body has been dehydrated, so it won't further decompose. Some people do restrict the use of the term to bodies deliberately embalmed with chemicals, and that's the kind I'm going to talk about most because they're the most interesting. So the use of the word to cover accidentally desiccated bodies as well goes back to at least the 1600s. Now, the most famous mummies are the...
Iceman.
No.
The Tutankhamun.
Egyptian mummies.
Right, those
yeah,
ones.
Yeah.
I thought you wanted specifics.
No, no. The most famous types of mummies are the ones from the...
Egyptian
culture.
Tombs.
Yes. That, yes.
The big triangles with rocks.
Yeah, pyramids.
That's them.
Yes, Egyptian mummies are the most well-known and the most famous, but there have been mummies found in multiple cultures all over the world.
Nice.
Both what we call anthropogenic or spontaneous. So anthropogenic is the ones where people have deliberately desiccated or dehydrated corpses and preserved them.
I get it.
Spontaneous are ones that have... due to atmospheric conditions, become mummies.
That probably relates to what we were saying before about incorrupt saints.
In some ways they are, yes. Apparently, over 1 million animal mummies have been found in Egypt, many of which are cats. So what? It's not just relating to human corpses, it's relating to animal corpses as
they
well.
They were very big on cats back then.
They were. I'm big on cats now.
Are you going to get Zelda mummified?
Not right now, no, she's still alive, that's weird. So anthropogenic mummies, which are the ones that we know of when we think of a mummy, the bandage wrapped... reanimated cursed thing.
Basically a zombie covered in toilet paper.
Pretty much, yep. Those were deliberately created by the living for any number of reasons, most commonly religious purposes. Spontaneous mummies are created unintentionally due to natural conditions like extremely dry heat or cold, anaerobic conditions. There are examples of both types being connected to a single culture. The natural preservation of the dead was really the first influence on Egyptian religion. Deliberate mummification only became an integral part of the rituals for the dead beginning as early as the Second Dynasty, so that's about 3400 BCE.
It's a while ago.
This is about 1500 years earlier than we initially thought. This is new research that has come to light within the last decade or so.
We originally
thought people were only being mummified about 2000 BCE, but actually it's a lot further back than that. In Egypt specifically. At first, the mummies we know of that were very early on, the spontaneous kind, were buried in the very arid desert land. The extreme heat of the desert atmosphere meant that these bodies would be naturally preserved and dried out so that they did not decay. They, in fact, just kind of stayed dried out. As that happened, Egyptians began to see the preservation of the body after death as an important step to living well in the afterlife. So it began to gain religious significance. And as Egypt became a more prosperous nation, mummification as an intentional practice began to grow, and it started to become something more and more elaborate, and it would indicate social status, which is what we see with the pharaohs. It wasn't until about 2600 BC that Egyptian embalmers began to achieve what we think of as true mummification, which is the process that I'm going to discuss, the more famous process of taking out organs, wrapping in bandages, etc., etc. Clearly, this method began to be refined over many centuries, but a lot of the early experimentation isn't really known about. Or perhaps these mummies have been destroyed by being ground up into powder.
Hey, those people could have been your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents and have been cured of a life-threatening disease by eating ground-up mummy. You might not be here.
The craze for discovering mummies, and particularly the mummies of Egypt, wasn't really until the 1920s when people started to really begin to study this kind of thing. So studying how mummification was achieved in ancient Egypt has really advanced also in the last few decades with the invention of things like CT scans, where we can actually scan mummies without unwrapping them and severely damaging them.
And exposing them to the atmosphere, which they've been protected from all these
centuries.
Exactly.
So,
millennia.
We now know what the process was. A lot of the documents that directly describe the mummification process date to the Greco-Roman period. The majority of the papyri that have survived only describe the ceremonial rituals involved in embalming, not the actual surgical, physical processes involved, because it was a ritual of highly religious significance. So there were a lot of spells and charms and protections that went into the process of preserving a body. That's what's described. The main text that we look to understand the process of Egyptian embalming is in Book 2 of Herodotus's Histories. It is one of the most detailed descriptions of the Egyptian mummification process, including the mention of using natron in order to dehydrate corpses for preservation. The descriptions, unfortunately, are short and still pretty vague, so we had to infer a lot of the techniques from studying the actual bodies of mummies that we've recovered or stolen, depending on how you look at it. Initially, the Egyptians buried the dead in pit graves without regard to social status, which were often shallow, which meant the heat and arid atmosphere easily dried out and preserved the bodies. But later, the ancient Egyptians began burying their dead in coffins to protect them from wild animals in the desert. But once they realized, generally, that if you put a body in a coffin, it would rot. So over many centuries, they developed this method of preservation that we know of today. So first, the embalmers would take out all the wet bits. So the squishy internal organs, including the brain. In Herodotus' book, he describes an iron hook used to remove the brain.
Yes, this is famous.
That's what people think it is. But actually, we've realised that it was some kind of organic instrument used to liquefy the brain, like mash it up, and then let it dribble out.
Rachel Weisz lied to me in The Mummy.
That movie has a lot to answer for.
Hollywood lies!
It does. This is a very recent discovery, I believe. I was pretty shocked to learn that too. But when you think about it, it's a lot easier to get some liquid out than pull bits of something kind of jelly-like out with a hook.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a long time. Like, you'd be pulling those chunks out with that iron hook just all day.
Well, it'd just break up. It'd just really get hard bored. To get out. Brains are quite soft, so it's quite a lot of...
Speak for yourself.
No, they are, though.
Oh, okay. Speak for science, then.
They would just get rid of the brain. They didn't think it was important.
This is rubbish.
The other organs, such as the liver and the intestines and things, would be preserved in their own right in jars called canopic jars, and they would be displayed around the tomb. They were elaborate jars with the heads of different gods as lids to the jars. They're really beautiful to look at.
Yeah, I've really got one.
A reproduction of one.
Maybe. I mean, I did pay more than $10 for it. Yeah. So probably an original. Got Anubis on it.
They would start by removing the organs. The heart was, for the Egyptians, the most important organ, and that is the one that would be weighed in the scales against a feather.
The feather of your virtues, like...
Yeah, basically to see whether you were a good person or a bad person. Mm-hmm. So the mummy had to have the heart. It would be replaced inside the body. It was the feather of truth and justice, and that was weighed by Anubis. And if the deceased had done bad things, then their heart would be heavy and they would not be allowed into the afterlife. Instead, Amit, the crocodile, lion, hippopotamus god, would devour them. Only if the heart weighed the same as the feather could the deceased person go on into the afterlife.
Wait, exactly the same?
You have to be a good person.
But what if the feather's heavier? Are you too good?
I don't think that's how it works.
Okay.
Go study your hieroglyphics. Then the body was covered in natron, a naturally occurring substance with various sodium compounds in it. So it was basically a kind of salt, naturally occurring salt. That would cover the body for at least 40 days to dissolve all the body fats and absorb all the moisture.
So it wasn't moist anymore.
Stop it. Then once that was done, they would use linen to pad out the cavities of the body and treat it with herbs, oils, and resin to, again, waterproof the body once it had been dried out. The resin was also used to get the linen wrappings to stick to the body and make sure it stayed completely dry. They wrapped these bodies a lot. They were not meant to be unwrapped. Makeup, jewellery, and a wig were usually placed on the body during this process. Any missing or damaged parts would be replaced with wooden parts in order to keep the body whole for the afterlife, so they wouldn't be missing anything. They would place glass eyes in the eye sockets. The idea was to preserve at least a facsimile of a body as much as possible in order to keep them whole for the afterlife. And in the wrapping and various layers of the linen, amulets and charms were placed for you to carry on into the afterlife. This is also one of the reasons they mummified pets, is because they thought that if they mummified the pet, they would also go into the afterlife.
And likewise servants, no?
Sometimes, yes, if you were very high status.
Mm-hmm.
The embalmers wrapped the body in a lot of linen, and spells and rituals were performed to ensure safe passage into the afterlife. And finally, the body was fitted with a mask, a sort of final shroud with the mask visible, and put into a coffin, or a series of coffin, also known as sarcophagi.
Yes, and you could have up to 3 or 4 of them around you, couldn't you?
Multiple.
Or more.
Coffins. It depends, again, it depends on your social status. Poor people could not afford all the necessary items to provide mummification for their loved ones. I mean, linen was not cheap. Gold charms, gold amulets, that kind of thing. It's an incredibly detailed process. And of course, it evolves over time. We're talking about a culture evolving over thousands of years. So while this is the sort of basic process we know today, if you go to a museum or if you look up, there's a fantastic video from the Getty Museum on YouTube, which I'll put in the show notes. You can see the process. And there are loads of great videos on YouTube also of historians and researchers and archaeologists studying mummies using CT scans and things, which is really cool.
Again, so, we'll maybe link a few favourites in the show.
Yeah, so you can absolutely. See. So you can, I mean, you can go down a YouTube hole watching videos of mummies, which I may or may not have been doing this week as a form of escapism.
Is that where you've been all week?
Yep.
Right.
It's been mummy time. As I said, the British Museum has a fantastic exhibit. It is, I think, one of their permanent exhibits.
Yeah, it's been there a long, long time.
So those are the most famous, the Egyptian mummies. I'm going to take you through a brief whistle-stop tour of other cultures that had mummies. Actually, the Chinchorro tribe in Chile were mummifying their dead 2,000 years before the Egyptians, around 5,000 BC.
Oh, before it was cool.
Quite a few thousand years before it was cool. Some spontaneous mummies, about 30% of all the Chinchorro mummies we've discovered, have been found dating as early as 7,000 BC.
Oh, wow.
From the Atacama Desert area, where the soil is very rich in nitrates. While many cultures throughout the world have sought to focus on preserving the elite members of their society with mummification, the Chinchorro tradition actually performed mummification on all members of their society. The decision to preserve everyone is proven by the mummies we found, which are of the elderly, disabled, children, women, pretty much everyone. There's a real range of different types of mummies that you've found.
Nice. Egalitarian approach.
Yeah. And actually, it was often the case that children and babies received the most elaborate mummification treatment. Again, this is thousands of years of culture, so the way the Chinchorro preserved their dead, the way they created mummies changed significantly over the years, but several traits remained consistent throughout their history. For example, skin and all soft tissues, including the brain, being removed from the corpse. They put sticks reinforcing the bones. Well, the skin was stuffed with vegetable matter before reassembling, and the mummy received a clay mask even if the mummy was already completely covered in dried clay. And then they wrapped them in reeds and left them to dry for 30 to 40 days. These are interesting because they actually dissembled the body into various bits, took the skin off, put some sticks against the bones, and then reassembled, which I think is really interesting because obviously the Egyptians were much more about preserving the wholeness of the body. The Chinchorro seemed to be more about just preserving the body. The Chinese also mummified their dead. There are some amazing Chinese mummies that again dates back to about 1500 BC. The Assyrians and Scythians preserved their dead in honey, much like the mummified man we discussed. The Persians preserved them in wax, ancient Hebrews in spices and aloes, Asian Buddhists in resin and sawdust, Tibetans in salt. And then, as we briefly covered in our formaldehyde episode, alcohol was also a really popular preservation agent. So spontaneous mummification. We have some amazing examples of spontaneous mummification at our disposal. One of the most recent was the discovery of Otzi the Iceman.
The Iceman, yes.
Yep. Do you know about bog bodies?
Yes.
Found in peat bogs, both in the UK and Scandinavia. Those are types of spontaneous mummies. There was bodies found in salt mines in Iran. And Siberian ice maidens are another example. Now, England has a lot of mummies. Even though we didn't mummify people.
We are a country of acquisitions, historically.
That is colonialism at work. We went to a fascinating culture and we took their stuff.
To be fair, they didn't have a flag.
And actually, as part of Napoleon's forfeit for his defeat, we took the mummies he'd taken from Egypt.
Okay, I guess we had a bigger flag in that case.
Yep, that's one of the things we decided to take. And actually, I haven't been to Egypt, and I would absolutely love to go.
We can go to Egypt.
But a friend has, the lovely Chloe, And she reports that when you go into some of the pyramids, there are just signs saying, on loan to the British Museum. This statue is in the Louvre in Paris. This statue is in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. So you can see the active effects of colonialism to this day. I kind of feel like we should give some of them back. Particularly when you think about what we did at the height of colonialism in the 19th century, where we basically destroyed tons of mummies for fun.
Or food.
No, this was specifically for fun.
Oh,
not for medicine. This was a fad in Victorian high society.
As public entertainment?
Yes, public entertainment. Great Victorian explorers would come back with mummies, and as a soiree, you would have a mummy unwrapping.
Oh my god.
The explorers would essentially dissemble a mummy in front of lovely society, ladies and gentlemen, and...
Undid thousands of years of preservation.
Yep, and... Obviously, it's the Victorian era. We haven't worked out restoration techniques. These mummies would essentially be destroyed from exposure to atmospheric conditions they were never supposed to be exposed to. And my heart hurts whenever I think about all the amazing knowledge we could have gained. Around the same time in the 1800s, the curse of the mummy became a story. Now, what do you think of as the curse of the mummy?
All I can think of right now is a panel from a horrible histories book of someone opening up a mummy's tomb and the words doom coming out of it. Now I'm thinking of Timmy Mallet for some reason. I don't know why my mind's gone that way.
That's adorable.
Also the bit from The Mummy where they open up the tomb and salt, some sort of acidic salt which was kept in the tomb under pressure, fires out and melts their faces.
Yeah, so the idea of this kind of Indiana Jones, this trapped tomb to present invaders, and the idea of an ancient curse that if you disturb this ancient burial site, you will die. These seem to be manifestations of colonial anxiety over destroying ancient cultures. Question.
One of the reasons why people were cursed was because there's a horn outside the pyramids, and they just went in unannounced. They didn't toot and come in.
Yeah, there are no curses actually written on the walls of ancient Egyptian tombs. It's an Orientalist fantasy perpetuated by 19th and 20th century Western pop culture and colonial anxieties. It took a particularly dark turn in my other favourite period in history, the 1890s.
I was wondering when they were going to come
up. Oh my god, they're so relevant. They have made so many problems. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was particularly anti-Egypt. He thought it was a terrible place. And actually wrote a short story about a mummy's revenge in 1894, which you can still read. There's a brilliant book on the history of this erroneous idea called The Mummy's Curse, The True History of a Dark Fantasy, by a guy called Roger Luckhurst, who is a lecturer at Birkbeck. There's one final mummy that I'd really like to mention as a hilarious anecdote, which is what happens when Victorian people try to do mummification themselves.
Oh no.
And it is the case of the wonderful Jeremy Bentham. So Jeremy Bentham died in 1832, and he wanted an auto icon, basically his mummified body, to be preserved and displayed. And he was supposed to have his actual head preserved and put on top. But when the time came to preserve it for posterity, the process of desiccation went disastrously wrong, robbing the head of its facial expressions and leaving it decidedly unattractive. They substituted his real head with a wax head, and for some years the real head with its glass eyes reposed on the floor of the auto icon between Bentham's legs. So the students kept stealing the head. In 1948, the head was placed inside a specially constructed wooden box to give it more protection, but that was too large to fit inside the case with the auto icon, so it was displayed on top of the case until 1956, when it was put on a plinth over the door to the cloisters leading to the eastern staircase.
I love the idea that Jeremy Bentham wanted himself memorialised in this incredibly dignified way. And there's this history afterwards of his head just being moved around all over the place. Like this sort of Benny Hill treatment of his body parts.
This is a case of one of the reasons we should not taxidermy humans, which in our taxidermy episode we'll probably get to. There's a little brief history of mummies and how Victorian England and colonialism has probably ruined a huge chunk of information we could have gathered from these ancient cultures, and how we've stolen a bunch of them and should really give some of them back.
Love it. That was super duper interesting.
They're
yeah,
fascinating.
I really enjoyed
There's
that.
So much more interesting information you can find
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of Morbid Curiosities.
It's been so exciting. I've barely scratched the surface of mummies.
We may linger further on the letter M.
And we've got a really exciting episode coming up next week.
Something to look forward to. A reminder of this week's listener question, which was...
What is your favourite historical remedy? Doesn't have to be corpse medicine, but it would be cool if it was kind of weird and stupid.
Believe me, history has no end of weird and stupid remedies of one sort or another.
If you want to talk to us, you can find us all over the internet. Us on Twitter at...
Jim Crack Shows.
Find us on Facebook at...
Facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1.
On Instagram at...
Jim Crack Productions.
Or find us on our personal website...
www.JimCrackProductions.com. We hope to see some of you at Moribund.
On the 22nd of November, or the 29th of November, the 6th of December, or the 13th of December.
Until then... Thank you for listening to Morbid Curiosities. I've been your host, George Colley.
And I've been your other host, Rosie Cole.
Stay morbid.
And stay curious.